because I can't possibly understand.
Don, you want to start?
The old ones among us.
Oh, auditor, Senator Vickerman. The auditor has to leave, so as soon as Gary comes,
we'll do hers.
These three, top three, are all in the capital.
Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order.
Yeah, I signed the other ones too, I think.
Okay.
I have to sign all of you. I had to sign it.
Senator Betzel, which bill would you like to start with? 3120?
There's an amendment to that one. I think that, let me do a quick one or two here, Madam Chair, in case Senator Olson comes in. I don't know you want to get to her bill, so. Why don't we go to 3225? Is the ombudsman here?
All right, 3225 it is.
Right.
Yeah.
And Madam Chair, this bill came to me by the ombudsman for the Department of Mental Human Services, and part of the work of the ombudsman is to obviously look into issues, advocate on behalf of the client for the ombudsman. Most of this bill is cleanup language just to actually put in the statute the stuff that they normally do. But the reason why the bill actually came forward and we needed some changes is because apparently the Department of Human Services is interpreting some HIPAA statutes as to limit or even prevent the ombudsman's office from even sometimes having access to some of the records of some of the Department of Human Services clients, and even to the extent where they cannot copy the records for their own use, they actually have to have copies in order to actually do the work, and actually going and looking at the files and not being able to copy them is preventing them from actually working. So, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Roberta Opine from the Ombudsman for further discussion here.
Ms. Opine, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roberta Opine. I'm the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities for the state of Minnesota. We serve persons with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chemical dependency, and children with emotional disturbance. Our agency only has about 17 staff members, and we have 8 offices around the state that cover the entire state of Minnesota to service about 12,000 agencies, facilities, or programs. So you can see we're a reactive organization. We receive a complaint, or we have to have a reason to believe that the rights or that there's a problem on behalf of the clients served by these agencies and programs. Our statute was written 20 years ago. It served us very well for 20 years. We've had no major problems until this year. And that's when the Department of Human Services decided that if the word copies was not in there, then that meant we couldn't make or receive copies. We could come in and look at the records. Well, with 17 people, we can't be driving to facilities 2 and 3 times in case we get some new information that we have to check or cross-check. This includes the data on decedents because the number one priority listed in our legislation as things we should review are deaths and serious injuries of persons receiving services. So we need to be able to get in and look at the records, what transpired before the person died, what are the gaps in the system. I will try to make this short. I want to leave with you the fact that in the 20 years the ombudsman has been in existence, no client or family member has ever complained to us that we have abused our authority on access to records, nor have we ever been accused of improper re-release. We've had some discussions between departments about what private data is and what's public data, but we added the comfort language, which was always in place. We were always obligated to follow Chapter 13 on the classification of the data, but we added that directly into the statute to provide some comfort language. We're still trying to work with the Department of Human Services to find a way to work with them in a way that addresses some of their concerns. But we can't have 12,000 different manners in which we gather records and different agreements with different facilities. So fundamentally, we're asking you to add the definition gather, which then includes the word to receive copies. The rest of it is all cross-referencing with the assistance of the Department of Administration to kind of clean things up, make them clear so people understand what the role of the ombudsman is. With that, Madam Chair, committee members, I would respond to any questions.
I know that Ms. Engler from the Department of Admin is also here to answer questions, if anybody has questions. Any questions for Senator Betzel or Ms. Alpine? Anybody in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for many, many years, I've worked with Ms. Oppheim on a lot of issues. And recently, I was a member of a task force that related to ombuds people's issues, a different venue. And this is a very important bill, and I support this bill. And this office does many things. And I just want to say, I hope, and I very much encourage you to pass this legislation. Thank you for the few moments of your time.
Thank you. Any further discussions on the bill? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, if there is nobody else to be heard on this, then I move that Senate file 3225 be recommended to pass.
And be referred to the Senate floor.
Where else will it go?
That's where it will go. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, I think the next easier one to do would be Senate File 2754. And this is a bill that was brought to me by the, I believe, the School District Association. There's a requirement to have background checks being done certain employees of school districts, and the main part about this is to allow them to contract with third parties to do the background checks, because sometimes the BCA information is not sufficient to get it, so they actually have to get other sources of information. This does require, however, that any information that comes into possession of third party has to be confidentiality must be maintained. I'll turn it over to the witnesses here for further discussion.
Welcome to the committee. Who would like to start?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozlin, and I'm the lobbyist for the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And we are just here. School districts are mandated by state law to perform a BCA background check on all proposed employees. And we are just here to ask for a change in the statute to allow the school district to use a third party to do the BCA background check. This legislation is also supported by the Minnesota School Boards Association and the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And we have Annie Doty, who is the Human Resources Director in the Wayzata School District, to talk about the need for the bill.
Ms. Doty, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Our objective is to keep our students safe. Metro districts typically do about anywhere from 500 to 1,500 background checks a year. For the Wayzata Public Schools, we have 1,600 employees, but we do about 600 background checks a year because we do all of our student teachers, coaches, chaperones, any new employees, and volunteers. We have, in the last probably 5 years, we have used a private vendor because we are able to get a more comprehensive background check from the private vendor, and it's done in a very timely manner. So we would like to be able to have the private vendors do our BCA check through the private vendors. And I think the language that's been drafted, we worked with the BCA. They were very supportive. And also we've worked with several other organizations to make sure that the vendors are subject to all the data privacy laws. And the proposed language also gives the BCA the ability and the authority to regulate the vendors.
Any questions for Senator Betzel or the two witnesses?
Madam Chair, apparently there's an A2 amendment. It was just handed to me. I don't know what it does, but, you know, somebody. I don't.
I,
I don't.
Does anybody here at the table know about the? Oh, is that? Did that come from you guys?
Yes, it's right. Madam Chair.
Okay.
They say the House adopted it. We don't do things the way the House does, but if it makes sense, I'll ask. But I don't know what it does.
All right. Well, I need to get a copy of that.
They were just handed out.
Oh, there it is. I'm sorry. All right.
2754.
All right. Who's going to explain the A2 amendment?
I can, Madam Chair. Thank you. Madam Chair, subdivision 2 on lines 1.5 through 1.16 of the amendment just clarifies that if an individual was denied employment as a result of the background check, that the school district informs them as that's the result of the background check. Subdivision 3 remains the same as the language in the bill. Subdivision 4 remains the same with the exceptions of lines 2.1 through 2.21. They just clarify that the result of the background check can be made available to the individual who requests it. Clause C says that the individual who's the subject of the background check has a right to request and obtain to challenge the accuracy of the results of the background check. It's just consistent with sections of statute.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
Senator Betzold, Ms. Doty. Doty, is that right?
Doty.
Right, okay. Were you notified by the BCA that you no longer could use the third-party vendors, or why do we have a bill here?
We were notified that we cannot get our BCA check through the third-party vendor, so we basically are doing two different background checks. And what we'd like is the BCA to be able to give the background check to the private vendor so it can all be – they would do the entire process.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
The Minneapolis Park Board, you know, who has all the volunteers who coach and work in the parks, was notified that they could no longer use the Minneapolis Park Police to do their background checks. And I've been trying to check into that and see if there's another way of doing it. So I don't know if the BCA has changed its regulations or what, but I think we'll be seeing more of these kinds of things to deal with the fact that we're running huge numbers of background checks through BCA, and having a third party do this kind of seems to make sense to me.
Senator Higgins, I think there's someone from the BCA here who might be able to answer your question.
Well, that'd be great if we could. And I know I did check into it, and I can't remember what they said, but they said they'd keep looking into it for the park board anyway.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Senator Betzel.
Senator Foley, is it on this point or is it a different point? Because we're going to get a response to Senator Higgins' question. I'll come back to you. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Letourneau-Lackner. I am a manager with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, the statute that requires the background checks for school employees specifically states that the school hiring authority must do that check directly through the BCA. And I believe there was another issue with the park police and the park board and the background checks that they were conducting through the police department, and that has been straightened out with them.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, are we fixing that piece of statute, or are we just writing something else someplace else for the schools?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, this that you're working on here is specifically for the schools. There's a statute that relates specifically to the schools.
Thank you.
Senator Betzel, I seem to recall that this looks awfully familiar to a bill that came up in the committee last year, where one of the questions that we had discussed at the time was and I think it was brought up at the same time as your data harvester bill was also brought up. And the question we had was, where do these third-party contractors get their information? And then once they get that information, they've provided the information to the school districts. What do they do with that information? So in essence, like, who owns that information? Do the data harvester people get to hold on to the information, or does that get purged, or what happens to that? And I guess I'd like to have somebody refresh my memory on what the answer was to those questions. Ms. Doty?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I talked to our vendor. Our vendor is Orange Tree, so I wanted to make sure I understood it also. And they're regulated by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and our legislation would also make sure they had the data privacy laws also. But the federal act outlines compliance, disclosure, disposal procedures, procedures for cases of disputed information, and penalties for unauthorized disclosures. What they told me was that they do not own the information. We are contracting with them, and we own the information on the person that we are getting the background check on.
So, Ms. Doty, what's the disposition procedure that they have for the information?
the disposal information? You know, I got a copy of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, but it's about 84 pages long, so I didn't read through it. But they assured me that it was our information. Their regulations were very, very tight, and they were also, you know, high penalties for them if it wasn't disposed in an appropriate manner. But I think part of what our legislation does now is that they are under the same data privacy laws as we are, as a school district is, with this legislation. So they would have really the Fair Credit Reporting Act and the data privacy laws to cover those concerns for our individuals.
Well, that's reassuring. I'm still interested in knowing what the mechanics of it. Is there a third-party vendor in the room who could provide us with some more detailed information? Senator Foley, I'm sorry I cut you off earlier.
You stole my
I stole your thunder,
question,
I'm sorry.
By and large, but I do think that before we go any further with this, that we should have some knowledge of the questions that you posed, plus some of the folks at the center. It seems to me that we need some control over who can do this, what are the qualifications, what are the penalties, and so forth. And so I'd like to see this these laid over until we can get enough information whether we should do anything with it or not in this session, or whether we can do it.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Doty.
I do have a copy of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and I do have it's under 628 of 15 U.S.C. 168.1. Would you like me to give this to you?
Well, what does it say, Ms. Doty?
Good morning. Not later than 1 year after the date of enactment. Hold on. Let's see. I got to read through it. I'm sorry. Okay. Regulations must be consistent with the requirements and the regulations issued pursuant to Public Law 106 or 06 through 102.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I think I would have to go to the next public law. It looks like it just references another public law on the disposal records.
Chair.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, is there any possibility of having these folks look at some kind of a discussion while we move on to something else?
Ms. Doty, is there? Can you contact somebody who's a third-party vendor, and maybe we're going to be here all day? Maybe they could stop by, and we can ask a couple of questions.
Okay.
This bill has come up a couple of times, and so it must be something that's pretty important to the school districts to want this done. And to the extent that we can help facilitate that, we'd like to do that. And the best way to do that is to have some of our questions answered. So, and, you know, for the people who are advocating on this bill, it's not as if we haven't asked these questions before. So And I think the reason why we laid the bill over last time was because we couldn't get answers to some of these questions. So maybe we could try to get somebody here who could answer those questions. I'm sorry, Senator Betzel.
No, that's fine.
Laid over.
Yeah, that's fine.
So Senate File 2754 will be laid over for future consideration.
Madam Chair, could we look at Senate File 3120?
Yes. Senate File 3120.
And should be a first engrossment of the bill. And I also believe I've got a technical amendment to clean up some matters that were done in
The A2 amendment, Senator Betzel?
Should be, yes.
All right. You want to explain that?
Yes. I didn't get a copy of the A2 amendment. I think Ms. Pontius gave me a copy, but I don't see it right here.
We'll get you a copy.
One of the things that we did in the State and Local Government Committee was, I'll describe the bill first and then describe what the amendment does. The bill does require that meetings that, if there's a closed meeting under the open meeting law, if a public meeting is closed, then the closed meetings, they have to maintain, they have to record the meetings and maintain the recordings for at least 3 years. Now, there's no triggering mechanism that makes the recordings public, so they can always stay closed. And the reason why that this is done is that, you know, if some matters that were discussed, if a meeting was closed and it should not have been closed, and there happens to be a lawsuit and somebody, you know, brings forward and they have produced the recordings to the a judge. A judge can review them, presumably in camera, you know, and without going public, and determine whether or not the meeting should have been closed and whether the information, you know, should be safeguarded. Now, this would not apply to attorney-client privilege matters, which is what the A2 amendment does. Also, I think we had to clean up some language on the recording part of it because we did not want it. It wasn't clear what the recordings were. We want to make sure that the original bill said tape recordings, and of course that's kind of an obsolete technology. But we didn't want the recordings also to be the handwritten notes referred to in here. So I don't know. I think Mr. Bodern was going to try to correct something here, and I don't know whether this the A2 amendment does that, but that's the A2 amendment is kind of cleaning up some of the language that we talked about in GovOps.
Senator Betzel, Senate Counsel says that the A2 amendment does achieve that.
Good. Okay. I'll move the A2 amendment. This is actually consistent. I see. Electrically recorded. That's the key that we were looking for, so that it was not going to be just any notes that were taken that were going to be somehow have to be preserved. Or affected by this. So,
any questions to Senator Betzel on the A2 amendment? Senator Betzel moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
We have a few witnesses here who wish to testify on the bill, Madam Chair.
Let's see. We have, are these Mr. Anthonson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. This bill is the product of sort of an accumulated frustration over the past few years with the open meeting law. The law has, in effect, become advisory more than anything else. It has no effective enforcement mechanisms. And as I have been around the Capitol the last couple of years, I have, in fact, been approached by legislators on both sides who have said to me, is there something we can do to strengthen this law to make it more effective? There have been a lot of frustrating situations in local communities, as you have all heard. My response was, if you don't strengthen somewhat the enforcement mechanism, you might as well not bother, because the centerpiece of the current problem with the open meeting law is the cost of litigation to effectively enforce the law. You must prove specific intent now to get attorney's fees, for example. It's impossible, for all intents and purposes, to prove that. So nobody really even tries. The two main things this bill would do to help the law slightly, as Senator Betzold said, it would create a recording requirement, which in my experience will be a significant deterrent to improper closed discussions. Secondly, it would not require a court to find specific intent to violate the law before it can award attorney's fees. Currently, the law does require that very high standard. Now, let me be real clear about that point, because I know you've heard from folks representing the governmental bodies that that's a bad change. All the change proposed there does is restores the law to what it read from 1973 to 1994. It doesn't do something new. During that entire period of time, attorney's fees awards were rare. Courts aren't going to award them for technicalities or trivial violations. But at least they can award them if it's a serious case, short of specific intent to violate the law. Secondly, there's a $13,000 cap that stays in the law on attorney's fees. So in the worst case, the attorney's fees awarded would only be $13,000. I'm ashamed as an attorney to tell you that's chicken feed in the modern world of legal fees. So this isn't some great new shift in the law. It only gets back to what we had up to 1994, and it really did work pretty well up to that point. Thank you, members.
All right. Ms. Kupinski, did you want to testify, or you just want to answer questions?
Madam Chair, I was just going to make a brief comment on the bill. Welcome. I'm Lori Barr-Kupinski. I'm the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division at the Department of Administration. My division assists the Commissioner of Admin with her statutory duties to issue advisory opinions on data practices and open meeting law. And while we don't have an official position on the bill, I wanted to provide information on how this might impact our citizen customers. Currently, government entities who follow an advisory opinion are given protection from civil and criminal penalties. And currently, citizens can be awarded attorney's fees based on data practices opinions. This bill extends that same ability to open meeting law opinions. And extending the attorney fees provision is likely to promote the kind of compliance with the open meeting law that you would like to encourage. And this bill will also increase the value and strength of open meeting law opinions so that they are comparable to data practices ones.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you both. Are there any questions for these two witnesses? We have a citizen citizen advocate who would like to testify, Mr. Michael Unlin. I apologize if I messed up your name.
Better than just about everybody. And first thing, I'll kick back an apology too. Apparently, that protocol is a little different than just being able to look at something and speak off the cuff. So my apologies to Senator Betzold also. I just happened to see this bill. I was here for a different purpose, and had a very strong agreement, especially after some discussion with some of the people behind the bill, about how important it is to strengthen enforcement and keep data available in case it's needed. There's just one piece that bothers me with respect to this, and that is that the government entity needs to have been the subject, or the government entity needs to be the subject of a prior written opinion. What that would mean is that if there was an advisory opinion associated with open meeting law or data practices law, for that matter, that said Ramsey County has been given an advisory opinion about this, that advisory opinion then only relates to Ramsey County relative to a citizen trying to enforce, let's say, Hennepin County to follow the advisory opinion. Hennepin County under this wouldn't face the possibility of attorney's fees because they were not the subject of the advisory opinion that went to Ramsey County. And this would create a checkerboard across the state for citizens to have to deal with instead of the law and the clarification of the law by advisory opinions. Everybody would have to fight their own battle with each entity as opposed to there being general applicability. And that's just a concern for me as a citizen, thinking that action has to be brought before an entity is subject to the law with the advisory opinion clarifications of the law. And I thank you for the opportunity to simply air that concern here. And then more broadly, I'll just state relative to data practices.
Thank you for your input.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I have a question of Senator Betzold. In the language on page 2, the paragraph E, is the, and I looked quickly at chapter 13 and 13D, can you tell me what government entity means? Does that mean the entire board or part of the board, or does it mean a member?
Actually, Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, I was just talking to Lawyer Barb Kopinski from the Department of Administration, and we think that the term public body is probably the better term here rather than government entity.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, to that point, if I may.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, then is one person or two people a public body?
Ms. Byer-Kropinski?
Madam Chair, Senator, it is the entire body.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I might then, a prevailing plaintiff could get attorney's fees against, if their action is against the entire body and not against a single member here as of paragraph E. Paragraph D is a different story, but in D you're allowing attorney's fees against a member. Current law says that there are none against a member, but E is about the whole body, I'm guessing.
Ms. Byer-Kropinski or Senator Betzel?
Well, as I say, Madam Chair, I think the proper term probably should be public body rather than government entity. So
Senator Betzel moves that on line 2.28, delete government entity and insert public body. Any further discussions? All those in favor? Two places? Where's the other place?
Madam Chair, members, it's 2.11.
2.8 and 2.11, I'm sorry.
All right. And then also on 2.11.
Yes.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Then, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think I'd like to take out, I think I'd like to restore current law on paragraph D. Because I understand against the body itself, and I think that the whether it's a city council, a school board, or a county board, they could pay. I think earlier current law says that they could, in paragraph C, a public body may pay that. But I would like to take attorney fees out of paragraph D. And my thinking is that I think this could be rather chilling in terms of a person wanting to run for public office when you might be personally liable for something unintended, some unintentional violation. And I don't want to say this really, but I mean, of all the bodies to rail against closed meetings, we're a fine lot. So,
Senator Betzel?
Well, but Madam Chair, it requires specific intent to violate the chapter. I think that's a pretty high standard. Somebody actually had to want to close down something that should have been public and hide something from the public. I mean, if current law says that no monetary penalties or attorney fees, if you take that out, I mean, finding specific intent, is going to be a high thing. But if there's specific intent to violate the law, why shouldn't the person be responsible?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move to take attorney fees out of there.
On Senator Scheid's motion, anybody want to testify or respond to
that? In other words, restore it, correct?
Yes, please. People hovering,
yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sulem, General Counsel for the Minnesota Association of Townships, and we would strongly support Senator Scheid's motion. We actually had a case a year ago, or a little over a year ago, where the town board not only didn't have specific intent, they actually had gone to their attorney and asked, do we have to do the following under the open meeting law? They actually sought legal advice. Now, I think there's some strong agreement that the advice from the attorney may not have been the best advice, but nonetheless, they sought attorney advice. They relied on that attorney's advice. The court still found that they shouldn't have relied on the advice, and therefore there was intent, and they were awarded the prevailing party was awarded attorney fees against those town board members And as Senator Scheid indicated, if you're out in the rural areas or even in the metro area and somebody says, well, you did your best, you sought an attorney's advice, you still have to pay $13,000 plus your own defense costs, that's a pretty chilling effect on wanting to serve in public office. Now, I know Mr. Anfinson, when we talked about this, said, well, that's an anomaly, but the fact is it happened. And unless we restore it to current law, that is the risk that you're going to have a judge out there saying, well, in this situation, I'm still going to find a way to impose the fines. And if we return it to current law, at least we're trying to make sure that there is a good threshold and not that type of scenario that we had last year.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Betzold, if you know or if one of your witnesses know, did that scenario incur under the same statute that requires that you would have to be able to prove specific intent to violate the chapter? Because as you said, that is a pretty high standard, and I would think that if someone relied on advice from their attorney, that would negate specific intent to violate the chapter. So I wonder if the standard that was being used was the same.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Senator Olson, yes, that case did occur under the specific intent, and that's our point. It's the proponents for making the change in the bill as it is are saying, you know, it's this really high threshold, that finding the specific intent is really a high threshold. What we're saying is the judges are already finding little ways of modifying it and not necessarily going as high of a threshold as they're advocating that it is. And so now to lower that threshold and say that it could be an involuntary, or not an involuntary, but an accidental, just honest mistake, and they're still now subject to attorney fees, is the wrong standard to go to. If we need to try to figure out better definitions than specific intent, I think we'd be willing to work on that another year. But this amendment, unless Senator Scheid's motion prevails, would allow those judges to say, hey, it was unintentional, but I'm still awarding attorney fees. And like I said, under the higher standard that they're trying to say exists that bars attorney fees, even under that high standard, the fees were awarded. And so to lower that standard makes it very problematic.
Mr. Anfinson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, I understand why my good friends who represent the public bodies don't like this, but I am frustrated in the sense that no citizens, except for the gentleman who came out of the woodwork here to talk to you today, they don't have their lobbyists. They don't have advocates who get to come up here and tell you how completely enfeebled the open meeting law is, because in the entire 14 years since you changed this statute to put specific intent in, there's been one award of attorney's fees. And with respect to the good counsel for the townships, you can't, in 2 minutes that I have here, absorb the entire litigation that involved Cannon Falls Township. What happened there was a conspiracy between this township's attorney and the town board. It wasn't straightforward legal advice as we normally consider. The town board and its attorney effectively conspired to try and stop these two hobby farmers who lived in the township, and there was a big fight about feedlots. And, I mean, read the Court of Appeals decision. I went to the Court of Appeals. The town board members' behavior in concert with their attorney was so egregious that they were removed from office, which is only the second time in state history that's happened. I mean, this wasn't a garden variety case. There was ample evidence. Believe me, Senator Olson, specific intent. It is the exception that proves the rule. It's the only case in 14 years since the law was changed where this has happened. No other citizen has ever been able to overcome this enormously daunting threshold.
Mr. Stahm?
Madam Chair, with all due respect, and again, it is a very complicated case, but this idea of a conspiracy theory was the rationale thrown out by the other side. In fact, the members of the board were under subsequent appeals, offered their chance back to have their seats restored because of what they had been through. They said, no, we're not going to do that. The attorney involved in this alleged conspiracy had actually sought advice from multiple outside counsels and the Board of Professional Responsibility as to what the proper role was. So getting into that kind of discussion
is not what's at issue here. The bottom line was the board did seek attorney's advice. The attorney sought additional counseling. We can disagree as to what actually was the outcome and advice, but the point is there's now precedents out there for trying to avoid violations and still getting socked with the fees, and we would support the Scheid Amendment.
Madam Chair, can I say quick additional thing? I apologize. I know you're busy. I understand Senator Scheid's concern, and it's a legitimate one. The fear is that honorable citizens will be nailed by some random judge. Not that I think there are such people on the bench, but who knows? There could be. So that's a legitimate concern. And one option, and I just throw this out, in the 21 years the law read as it would be restored to her, that never happened. Officials weren't nailed for technical or inadvertent violations. The judge had to be pretty strongly persuaded. But you could make this attorney's fees payable by the public body and not the member, and that would take care of the problem with deterrent. Because you don't violate the open meeting law in most serious cases unless there is a quorum of the public body that has committed the violation, in effect.
Senator Scheid, your amendment seems so benign.
Madam Chair.
When you first suggested it.
Madam Chair, who would think?
we have another witness.
Below me. Madam Chair and members, I think that those members of those, public entities, public bodies, excuse me, would have to have an intent. I mean, they shouldn't be up against the fact that they might have to pay attorney's fees, the plaintiff's attorney's fees, if they didn't have an intent. I mean, unintentional violations, I think, do happen. I know they do. And I suppose that there may be conspiracies someplace where they do this. I'd argue probably if they went to get an opinion, they had some intent to do something. If they were nervous about what they were going to do anyway. But so the judge may have found specific intent, and I don't want to speak on that case because I know from nothing about that, just what you two gentlemen have said. But I don't think that anybody should be up against paying those attorney's fees if it's inadvertent, unintentional. And I think you should have to show that they had a specific intent. I don't know if the word specific makes it a stronger element or factor or not, but I think they certainly have had to have had intent if you're going to find attorney's fees.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, maybe I'm confused because I thought what we were looking at was taking out the language that they would be allowed to have attorney's fees that does require specific intent according to the way that this is written. So, mm-hmm. So I guess I'm confused because it seems to me that if we supported Senator Scheid's amendment, we would be removing the possibility of attorney's fees even when in the specific wording is, if we're looking at the same thing, it says that the court has to find that there was specific intent to violate the chapter. So that was my understanding, and if that's something that Senator Scheid, if we are on the same page on this, then rather than changing what she was suggesting initially, I would suggest that we would change award against a member and just delete the against a member so the award would be against the public body as was suggested by the witness.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, current law is that no attorney fees may be awarded unless the court finds there was specific intent. So that would be current law, and I'm fine with that. It's when you take attorney fees out of that, you're saying that you might have to pay attorney's fees even without a showing of specific intent.
Ms. Anfinson?
Madam Chair, just one quick response to Senator. Again, I appreciate what she's trying to do, but I have litigated cases involving the open meeting law seeking to prove specific intent. And what happens when you get in court that unless the defendants, the members of the public body, essentially admit that we plan to violate the law, that we knew what the law required and decided to ignore it, you will never prove to a court, according to the rules of evidence, specific intent. It just can't be done. I wish it were. I agree with your concept philosophically, But because the rules of evidence in court are so difficult, unless the members admit it, you don't have circumstantial evidence in these cases. And so the court says, sorry, we're troubled by what happened, but you didn't prove specific intent. And what you've done then is completely, again, disabled the ability of citizens to enforce the law. Because when they call attorneys like me, I say, don't even bother. You're not going to get your attorney's fees. Well, then how much is it going to cost me? $10,000 to $50,000. Click. That's the end of the conversation. And that's where we are in the state right now.
Mr. Dean.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. I think I would take issue with several of the things that Mr. Anfenson has said about this. Senator Scheid is right on this. You can get attorney's fees that are awarded against the body under this thing. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about here in that language on 2.5 is attorney's fees awarded against an individual member of the school board or against an individual member of the city council. Now, Mr. Anfenson may classify if you serve in one of those positions and get $20 a meeting or $200 a month and you get a $13,000 award against you as chicken feed. I don't believe that our members think that that's chicken feed when that's a personal liability on them. If you take this language out, it reinstates the present law and says the member has to have known that they were violating the open meeting law in order to have a monetary penalty or attorney's fees awarded against them. There could still be attorney's fees awarded against the public body if there was a violation. And let me give you some examples of ways that you can get tripped up. Somebody forgets to give the correct notice. You don't have the information in the room that's being discussed at the time that it's being discussed. Somebody does something wrong that they didn't understand was wrong, not intentionally, and that's a violation of the open meeting law. And in theory, if somebody brings the action, they could get attorney's fees. Now, Mr. Anfenson has said that no judge would award that. But I would tell you, when I 5 years from now, if I'm sitting there and I'm looking up at that bench and I'm saying, Judge Anfenson, I don't think that you ought to be awarding these fees, I'm afraid of how that's going to turn out. You never know what judge you're going to have or how that judge is going to rule on that. And I think that the telling these people that are doing this sort of public service that they're going to have that personal responsibility for those attorney's fees when they didn't intend to violate the law is really a bit much.
Right. Gentlemen, I think that we're fully informed on the two sides in this issue. Senator Scheid, do you renew your motion?
Yes, I do,
to
Madam
restore
Chair.
The stricken language on line 2.5. Any further discussions from the members? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe we can take another look at this. Also, perhaps if we took out the reference to the member of the public body, to just be referring to the public body. No, I mean, the current law, because of the Scheid Amendment, would stay in, may be awarded against a public body. And if we also struck the word specific, you know, that I think that would strike a balance in here. That it would be against the public policy, but there have to be intent. And I think intent can be gleaned from the circumstances as opposed to specific intent, as Mr. Anfenton said, where you said, you know, look, I plotted, I planned to violate the law, and I actually did so. So maybe that would be a better balance in here to, as I say, strike the reference to the member and strike the specific.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, if you looked at line 2.3, and this is why I supported Senator Scheid's motion once I understood this better, looks to me that you can already get attorney's fees against the public body if there's a violation under this, and that section subsection D was just specifically directed toward members, and that would be why it was in there.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, could you, you're on 2.3?
Yeah, she says it. Somebody takes care of it. So
For the members. What that paragraph says is the public body can pay fees awarded against a member if it wants to. Okay, that's part of the 1994 amendments with specific intent. In reality, however, the practical political context that you'd have is if you had members who had been held by a court to specifically intended to have violated the open meeting law, consciously disregarding the law, it would be a rare public body that would conclude that the taxpayers should still have to pay their fees. So that isn't how it works now. That the public body can, but it certainly does not have to pay the fees of a violated member. And I don't think it ever would, hardly, voluntarily. Okay. Again, where you have specific intent as your standard.
Senator Betzel, are you going to move that language, or are you just putting it on the table for discussion?
Fine with it.
I'll move that we... I move to strike the word specific on line 2.6.
So just the word specific on line 2.6. Any further discussion from the members?
Madam Chair, it would have to be A to Ann has to go and, as well.
Yeah.
And it's my function. I'm sorry.
And insert Ann. So delete A specific and insert Ann.
Yes.
Line 2.6. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator, any other testimonies on Senate File 3120 as amended? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, if there is no further discussion or testimony, I'll move the Senate File 3120 as amended be recommended to pass.
Any further discussions from the members? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Prevails.
Appreciate it. Thank you, members.
Senator Bessel, we're going to have Sarah Olson present Senate File 2754 so we can get her witness on her way.
Sorry,
3716. My bad. Once again, our state auditor visits us.
Hey.
Sarah Olson.
Madam Chair, members, I'm happy to be here on behalf of Senate File 3716 with State Auditor Rebecca Otto, who has brought this legislation forward that would give privacy protection to data that she has reviewed by third parties as part of doing her performing her function. And with that, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Auditor Rebecca Otto.
Auditor Otto, welcome back to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a nice committee to be in, and members. This is just a technical bill. It's very simple. It's something that really is clarification. The new language clarifies but does not change the classification of information shown to local governments for review and verification during an audit. I think this language is actually in statute for the legislative auditor. We would like it in statute for our office as well, just so that it's very clear that when we're doing an audit and we let them review it before we issue it, that they cannot show it to anybody else that's not in public.
Very good. Any questions to the auditor or to Senator Olson? Anybody in the audience would like to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Olson, what is your desire?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 3716 be recommended to pass and referred, I believe, to the floor.
That's where it will go. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel isn't here. Senator Olson, do you want to do...
Madam Chair?
Yes? Senator Higgins?
There were two amendments that were in our packet for that last bill.
That's for 3235, which we're going to take up right now.
Oh, that was the other one. I'm
yes.
so sorry.
Yes. Senator Olson, are you prepared to do 3235?
Two amendments on that one.
3235 has already been reviewed by the Data Practices Subcommittee. But because instead of doing omnibus data practice bill, which members, we didn't have enough to put together one. We just, I believe the data practice subcommittee decided to hear the bills and then recommended them onto the full committee. And so we don't have subcommittee reports, but Senator Olson is going to be speaking to them. So the two amendments before you have already been adopted in the subcommittee, but because it's been forwarded to us by recommendation, let's go ahead and adopt those two amendments. So the A2 and A3 amendment. Senator Olson moves the A2 amendment. Any discussions? See none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now on the A3 amendment, as recommended from the Data Privacy Practices Subcommittee. Senator Olson moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now on Senate File 3235, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Primarily, this bill is a technical bill, and I will be asking Ms. Beyer-Kopinski to walk you briefly through those technical changes. But I would say that there is one substantive section of the bill, and that has to do with the A2 amendment, which is basically relates to the ability of the Department of Education and the Minnesota Office of Higher Education to share information with each other that would be that would be summary data only. It would not be identifying data, to be able to track students' progress from high school through to college programs. So that they can do not individual progress of individual students, but basically the overall success of certain programs and certain goals that they are attempting to achieve will be able to be measured by being able to share this summary data. And so in the Data Practices Committee, we had a presentation by the Commissioner of Education and as well as someone from the Department of Higher Education. We're both in support of this. And it seemed that there wasn't going to be a concern about disclosure of individual private data, specific data, and that this would be a good policy for the state to adopt. So if there are any questions on that section, there may be someone here from the department. Yes, there is someone here from the Department of Education who could speak to that if there are questions about that. Otherwise, I can turn it over to Ms. Beyer-Kopinski to walk us through the technical changes.
Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, why don't you walk us through the bill, and then once we're finished with the bill, we can turn to the A2 amendment for further questions.
Madam Chair and members, Section 1 of the bill deletes a reference to compiling copies, which is an old-fashioned wooden device before there were little trays on the end of our copying machines, and we deleted a similar reference last year in Section 1304, so we're making a corresponding change. Section 2 of the bill continues to replace the longer phrase for the shorthand government entity, which is a defined term in data practices. Section 3 just makes a grammatical correction to make data plural. And then Section 4 just corrects an incorrect cross-reference from when Chapter 13 was recodified.
So the word data is genetically plural?
Madam Chair, yes, it is.
Yes.
Please continue.
And then, Madam Chair, the A2 was there was an error, and the revisor struck out some existing language, and the A2 just corrects that.
And that's it?
Madam Chair, that's it.
That's it. Any questions on the body of the bill? All right. And then on the A3 amendment is technical. The A2 amendment is where the substantive piece of information is. I understand that the commissioner is here to answer questions, right? If anybody has questions, I understand that this information has already been thoroughly discussed in the data practices subcommittee. Members, anybody have any questions?
Madam Chair, I do have
Senator Betzel.
One additional item. And there was a bill that I...
Yes.
I'll have this distributed, and I'll talk about it, Madam Chair. Just about a week ago, I was contacted by Hennepin County on a data practices issue, and I pointed out the deadlines were coming up. And although they've known about them for quite a while, they all of a sudden discovered an issue and they wanted to have something done. And this is a bill that was just introduced, and I'd like to have the full committee take a look at it. I'll describe it. I believe some people are here from Hennepin County to discuss the matter, but here's the situation. At the Hennepin County Medical Center, the doctors have they've converted all their records over to computers, as most hospitals are doing, and the doctors have access, obviously, to the patient records on computers. In this particular case, however, the doctors have created their own corporation, which is like across the street from the hospital. So the doctors, you know, have their offices across the street, and they actually go to their wards to visit their patients. Because on computers, the doctors technically have access to the patient records when they're across the street in their offices. However, because they've created this nonprofit corporation, HIPAA says that they cannot be sharing medical records from the hospital to this nonprofit corporation. It's the same doctors, except that they're now, you know, in a different legal entity having access to it. I had actually two bills introduced. One was very specific to Hennepin County. This is more general because there's probably other situations where it could likewise occur. And I do have some folks from Hennepin County, I believe, who are here who can testify on it. And if they wish to approach the table, now would be the time to do so.
Senator Bitzel, let me get this correct. When the doctors go from their office to the hospital, they have access. They don't have access to the patient records that's at their office.
Yes,
or vice versa.
Madam Chair, my understanding is, of course, once they're in the hospital, the records are there. They're the hospital's records. They can bring the patient's records up because they're on computer now. But when they go to their offices as part of this nonprofit corporation, although technically they can log in, they're not supposed to because they're in a different legal status at that time. And so they don't really have access to the record. They're not supposed to have access because HIPAA would say that they shouldn't be doing that. So this would be allowing the physicians to have access to their electronic records and share them back and forth. You know, I mean, because when they're working at their office, they're obviously working with the same computers that are over in the hospital. And this is probably not going to be a unique situation to Hennepin County Medical Center. There's probably other situations around the state where the doctors want to have access to them without actually physically being in the hospital, but they're in a different state. I think they can explain it better than I can, as I say, but that's my understanding of what they wish to do.
And this can't be addressed through the HIPAA restrictions by consent. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I'm very concerned with having this go on, this bill, as an amendment. And I know that Senator Bitzel and I talked briefly about this yesterday evening, and I know that he expressed some concern as well about the fact that the public would not have had notice of this very, potentially very large issue. And I say that because the example being given sounds very innocuous and doesn't sound like any big deal. But this is not an amendment that would relate just to that one individual situation. We have nonprofit corporations, healthcare corporations in our state, like Blue Cross Blue Shield and others. And we have many corporations that are owned by for-profit or other corporations all around the country. I'm not able to sit here today and just kind of immediately envision the potential ramifications of this, but it seems to me that we could be allowing the crossing of lines without patients' notification and consent in a fairly broad way that we haven't had the opportunity for notice for those who might have concerns along this line to come in and talk about how widespread this could potentially be in terms of a change in the law. Certainly the example that Senator Betzold's raising sounds very, you know, understandable and non-threatening, but this is a very big and broad change potentially that I think should have
that this is not the way we should be considering it.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I'm looking at the very last sentence of the bill, and it does lay out that they have to be related health care entities for the purposes of some section and are not outside of the corporation's facilities. So it seems that this is actually fairly narrowly drafted, that it probably wouldn't affect those instances that you were talking about, Senator Olson. I know HCMC does have kind of a hybrid, maybe that's not the right word, but a working relationship with a nonprofit physicians group, and so they probably do have this data issue probably fairly big time.
Well, why don't we have the witness speak to see if we can get any more information?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Andy Mitchell, and I'm with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. My primary client is Hennepin County Medical Center, and I appreciate Senator Betzold's comments on the timing of its presentation, and I apologize for that. I would like to begin by saying that the legislation that we're looking at is not generalized. It's specific to Hennepin County Medical Center. The amendment we are suggesting is to 383B917, and 383B901 and the subsequent are the specific statutes that created a new nonprofit corporation to run Hennepin County Medical Center. That's Hennepin Healthcare System. We do have what is kind of a unique and complex situation at Hennepin County Medical Center. We have the medical center, which is now a subsidiary corporation of the county. We have Hennepin Faculty Associates, which is a nonprofit physician organization that is our faculty at a teaching hospital. And we're really here because the county also has other medical clinics, such as North Point, that are not under the umbrella of Hennepin County Medical Center. We do share an electronic health record between the hospital and the physician group, and that we have a contract for and we have operationally. What we would like to do now is to offer to North Point the opportunity to participate in that same electronic health record. And it's really in the issues between then North Point's data would be available at this Hennepin Faculty Associates and vice versa. We will certainly be seeking in the Tennyson warnings and the consents on a going forward basis that will let people know that. But what we're doing here is asking that for this corporation, that is to say for Hennepin Healthcare System, a nonprofit corporation providing physician services to that corporation, and the primary example of that is Hennepin Faculty Associates, participating in an electronic exchange of records may share medical data, but only for the purposes of treatment, payment, or healthcare operations. So we're asking only that we be able to share this data for the purposes of treating patients at North Point, HFA, or at HCMC, as that were to proceed. And the second prong here is, by the way, this language here was different than that which we originally proposed. I think your counsel narrowed it to notwithstanding Section 13384, and that's a good narrowing of the suggestion. And then the next clause is that the nonprofit corporation and the other participants in the exchange are considered related healthcare entities for the purpose of that statute, which allows for current treatment them to share data. And then finally, the Healthcare Bill of Rights describes, provides that you shouldn't share data outside your facility. It doesn't define facility. I'm concerned that people would consider in this context the facility to be the hospital, but we want to share that data with our physician group and with North Point, so I don't want them to be considered outside that facility for that purpose.
And, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, North Point is one of the federally qualified health centers, one of the 50 or 60 FQHCs. And and it is in my district, and it is the health facility for a significant number of people in the low-income category, and their, you know, their hospital that they would end up going to would be HCMC in most cases, I believe. So it seems to me that it makes sense.
Mr. Mitchell, can this be done with consent of the patients?
The challenge, I think, for us with the consent of the patient is twofold. First of all, we already have a lot of patients that are in the database that exists at Hennepin County Medical Center and HFA. And to go back to those people and try to consent its being available at North Point at this point would be very difficult. In this respect, I analogize it to if you go to Allina and you say, I consent for all of Allina's system to have my data, and they acquire a new practice group, they come into the umbrella, and they don't have to go back and get new consents. Here, North Point is its own entity. It's very related to us, but we're not acquiring them. And when we implemented the system, we didn't anticipate their need for this electronic record from us.
Mr. Mitchell, is there some concern, though, that while we want to help take care of your situation, that we might be, I mean, this affects a far broader, I mean, this is very general, so it sort of applies now all across the state?
Well, Madam Chair, that's
just Hennepin County. We're restricting it to just Hennepin County. I see.
Madam Chair,
Senator Olson.
Now that I understand the context of this and the references to these statutes, I'm not as concerned about that because it does seems like it's limited to this situation. The concern I would have, I guess I'm just trying to think of analogous situations, and when it's in the form of an amendment like this, it's kind of hard to envision without someone here to testify on the other side what some of the concerns might be. But, for example, in my town, we have a right next door a hospital and a clinic. They're not affiliated with each other. And so if I sign consent for release of records within one, I'm not agreeing to the other. And I guess I think that's probably okay, because if I go to the hospital and I want them to see the clinic's records, all I have to do is sign a consent, and then they'll be able to get the records. So I guess I'm just wondering, because we are so careful in other respects where we have people signing forms to say that they know exactly what they're releasing and who's going to get it and for how long, that if we can kind of after the fact add other entities in as we would be doing here, when all they would have to do as a patient, I guess I don't understand what the problem would be with getting the patient's signature if they're coming in for treatment so that they'd be allowed to have access to these records.
I think it's just a sheer number, Senator Olson. Mr. Mitchell?
There's also just kind of the baseline way the computer system works, in that if Andy Mitchell was a patient at the hospital and then Andy Mitchell went to North Point and said, I'd like an appointment, they'd type in my name, and if I'm already in the system, information would come up that I would give them to schedule my appointment anyway, but it would be an access to data that was already there in the system. And so that's before they can come in and actually see us. We won't see any medical data until they're present in our facility, and we can have them sign a release with respect to that. But demographic data is also considered medical data under 13384. So that's why it may be considered an abundance of caution, but I'm very concerned that that would be a problem for us.
Okay. Senator Foley, did you want to comment?
Madam Chair and Mr. Mitchell, is there any thing here on the supremacy side with the HIPAA legislation where we might be limited as to what we could do?
Mr. Mitchell.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't believe that we would be putting ourselves back in a HIPAA position. As a general rule, in Minnesota, our statutes are more restrictive than HIPAA. And I do not believe that this system would violate HIPAA.
Yeah.
All right. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify on the bill, which will, on Senate File 3664, which is being considered as an amendment to the bill? Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I may have pass this out to the members. And Madam Chair, I even remembered your point last year. I even said my name on Mr. Neumeister. And I just have enough copies for the senators and I believe the council. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm glad that it was saying it's not HIPAA. Why this piece of legislation is here. It's because of our state law. And you have a copy of 13.384 in front of you, and this is what I've shared with you. One of the things that the testifier has talked about, I forget your name, sir, Madam
Mitchell,
Chair.
Mr. Mitchell.
Mr. Mitchell has indicated, is that they already have a contract with HFC and HCMC where they share the information directly. So what we're talking about is where the corporation wants to do it with North Point. Now, the issue is what is North Point separate from Hennepin County, HCMC, or is it a part in that quasi type of what you might call a public entity or a quasi-public entity? That's one question. The second one I have a concern about is, as it's already been talked about, this legislation is broad. So if in the future, if HCMC starts to get in other relationships with other folks, that notwithstanding 13.384 will come into play. Now, if you look on 13.384, you'll see on the second page, subdivision 3, 1305 is consent. So that's one of the issues is, you know, why not do consent? And that has been talked about. So you're talking about the people behind. Now, I would suggest is I think this can be narrowed down or to say to the extent that those people that are behind, there shall be attempts to get their consent. One of the things, you know, I don't know how many thousands of people may not want certain folks to know about whatever they might have about them. Again, that's one of their choices. And I think a number of people will not be able to have that choice like they have had over the past type of laws. So, Madam Chair, in summary, I can understand what they're trying to do. I think it's an appropriate thing to do. I think it's too broad. I encourage it to be narrow. And somehow, some way, we should not diminish the right of those folks in the past. And also, if these kinds of things are going to be done in the future, how broadly, I think that policy needs to be addressed too. This as we develop in healthcare, particularly with the electronic exchange of records, I think we should go slowly. So, Madam Chair, for the record, those are my comments, and I've shared with you at least what 13.384 is about.
Thank you, Ms. Neumeister. Ms. Pontius, can you clarify something for me? This bill, 3664, is narrowly drawn to Hennepin County, right?
Madam Chair, yes. It's actually in the Hennepin County Medical Center statute.
Okay. And then, Ms. Pontius, within the language here, how many other nonprofit corporations, hospital type, how many other nonprofit corporations would this apply to within Hennepin County?
Madam Chair, members, I'd have to defer to the witness. I believe right now there's just one, but there might be a couple.
Mr. Mitchell, how many entities will be affected by this?
The question is, how many nonprofit corporations do we have that provide physician services to the corporation? And we have one contract with Hennepin Faculty Associates. They are our faculty group. I don't want to overstate it. There may be some contracts with individual physicians but HFA is the nonprofit group with whom we have a contract.
So the definition of a nonprofit corporation providing physician services would qualify just the one that you're contemplating?
Yes, I think that's correct.
Okay. Well, Mr. Mitchell, can you check on that for us? To the extent that Mr. Neumeister has asked for this to be narrow and narrowly applicable, the committee might want to be friendly to that thought. So can you check to see within Hennepin County if anyone else is affected or just the physician group that you're talking about? And then what I'm going to do is, Senator Olson, I'd like to lay over your bill. We have all day today, and I want to bring your bill up at the end of the day. There are a couple of dynamics that are going on here that I need to speak with you about after this is done. And so when we bring your bill back up, hopefully by then Ms. Pontius will have had an opportunity to draft this into an amendment into this bill. And then we'll reconsider whether or not we'll have an opportunity to include this into your bill. Senator Olson?
And Madam Chair, I guess just so I understand what you're thinking, are you thinking that perhaps we would just be naming that specific nonprofit corporation so that it would be more narrowly focused on that one rather than just anything that might come up in the future? Or
Senator Olson, not necessarily specifically naming the entity, but if we could define it. I mean, if this definition applies only to the entity, we want to draft it so that it's as narrow as possible. And I think that that should alleviate some of your concerns that it's too broad. I mean, I'd like to help them if we can.
And Madam Chair, I'm also concerned, as I indicated, by the lack of notice for everybody on this particular bill. One of the thoughts I've got, and there's some dynamics going on here, but you might consider, if we ultimately roll this into the data practice bill and pass it today, consider just listing this bill on an agenda for next week. If we have any testimony that comes out that we did not get today, would consider, you know, doing an amendment later on to make it consistent, you know, however the testimony goes. But there was not sufficient public notice here, and I'm really concerned about that, but I also recognize what we have to do to get things done today.
All right. Senator Olson, I would appreciate your willing to accommodate that, and we'll schedule the bill.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that suggestion.
Are there any other amendments to Senate File 3235? I'm going to lay over Senate File 3235, and we might come back. We will come back this afternoon to look at that bill. Thank you.
Talk to Mr. Mitchell about this. Let's see. What bill do we have left?
I've got two minutes. Well, that's 3914, Madam Chair.
Way too much time.
Yeah, Senator Betzel, why don't we take up 914? And members, 914 has already passed this committee and was on the Senate floor, and then we saw that there was an issue. And so Senator Betzold, we had it brought back here, and I think we're going to try to attempt to correct that.
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair and members. We did spend a considerable amount of time on this bill last year. This is a data harvesting bill on business screening services, and the concern that we had, it's analogous to once you open the pillowcase and the feathers are out, it's hard to get the feathers back in. Basically, once bad data is out and in these screening services, it's very difficult to go back and correct the information, and people are relying upon that information. So last year, we provided, you know, some information that, if you look at page 1, lines 15 and 16, a business screening service may not disseminate a criminal record unless the record has been updated within the previous 30 days. We do talk about some abilities to correct the information, and then if it's a frivolous, if it turns out to be right, at top of page 2, the business screening service will promptly delete the record, you know, if it's been sealed, expunged. If it's frivolous, you know, then the business screening services, you know, don't have to take any action. But as I say, this is the work that we had come up with last year. Now, after the bill got to the floor, there was some concerns about how this tied into federal law. And Ms. Pontius spent a bit of time looking into the matter, and she concluded that there were some implications with the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And she actually prepared an amendment for a possible floor amendment, because by this time the committee had already closed down for the year. And I was reluctant to take up something quite technical like this without bringing it back to committee, having members have a look at it, see if there's any public input on this. So although I had the amendment ready last year, I felt, just send the bill back to committee and we'd look at this again. So the A4 amendment is what we consider, which simply says that a business screening service in compliance with the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act is considered to be in compliance with this section. So we don't have, so state law is not trying to supersede federal law on this particular matter. I don't know if you've got
Senator
the
Senator Betzel, can you hang
amendment
on a second?
We're trying to find the A4 amendment.
It's the A8 amendment.
Oh,
A8.
A8. Very good.
It was getting a little bit loud, and so I'd asked the sergeants to quiet down, but apparently it's from the rotunda, not from the hallway. So. All right, I think everyone has the A8 amendment. Senator Betzel.
And again, Madam Chair, this body has prepared this last year to make sure that we are in conformity with federal law, and
okay,
that's basically my understanding of it. There may be some other people who have an interest in it, and whether it does or does not do it. No, this has been out for a year now. And because I had it released last year, so if anybody really has any heartburn on it, I have not heard anything.
Well, and the heartburn may have been the original heartburn that was exhibited in the committee to begin with.
But on the A8 amendment anyway,
right.
So.
On the A8 amendment, right? Let's adopt the A8 amendment.
And is there anybody else who has any issues on it, I guess?
I suppose. Mr. Tennyson. Do you want to speak on the AA amendment or the total bill? The total bill, right? All right. So let's adopt the AA amendment, and then we'll take testimony on the bill as amended. Any further discussions from members to Senator Betzel? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. So now we have Senate File 914 as amended, which should be should take care of the technical problem. We have Mr. Tennyson is going to speak, right? Mr. Tennyson?
I have some proponents of it. I don't know whether they need to bring some updates to the committee on, I don't know whether we need to repeat everything we said last year, but they may want to bring some updates if there's any.
Mr. Holmgren or Sikora, do you intend to give us a long testimony on this?
Madam Chair, I'm prepared to just speak in general support of the bill if you'd like. I wasn't aware that you'd actually done that last session, so I don't have anything else to add at this point.
Any members would like to hear from the proponents of the bill? For the record, I like to give the opponents of the bill an opportunity to speak. We did take some pretty comprehensive testimony on this last year. So.
Madam Chair, can I offer an update?
Sure.
Robert Sikora, and the agenda incorrectly lists me as working for the Minnesota Board of Public Defense. I'm, in fact, on loan to the Department of Public Safety to work on exactly these issues and to advise the committee today that there is a group of people working on a comprehensive set of responses to issues raised by the data harvesting industry. And I just wanted you to be aware that the Department of Public Safety is neutral on Senate File 914 and to advise you that a larger effort is underway. And we'll be back next year with a set of recommendations.
Mr. Sakura, if the Senate File 914 were to pass, would that have a role in the considerations that you are all taking in this area?
It certainly would, Madam Chair, and I don't see it as an impediment. It's one component of a multifaceted set of solutions and ways that the problem presents itself.
Very good. Thank you both. Any of the members have a question for either of the witnesses? Mr. Tennyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Tennyson. I'm with the law firm Tennyson Law, and I represent Reed Elsevier, which owns LexisNexis, and I think you're more familiar with that. I've given you a memorandum which outlines some of the issues, and I'd like to highlight a couple of them. First of all, to the extent that the issues of employment and credit are affected by this, they're preempted by the federal law, and nobody's going to pay attention to them here, they're governed by the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act. The second thing is that, Mr. Sikora briefly mentioned, I think the cart's a little bit before the horse here. This bill we heard last year. Then this year you received a report from the Criminal Records and Employment in Minnesota, which tries to deal with this whole problem of reentry. And it's a serious issue that's been, made more difficult by the rash of ill-advised criminal laws and collateral sanctions in the past and last 30 years. But in that, you also received a report on the Juvenile Justice Task Force, and they had a recommendation in there that we studied so-called data mining. And I've been attending those meetings, and they say that the memorandum said that the purpose of it is the first phase of the task force will involve compiling available research and materials relating to data mining and its consequences, as well as regulatory approaches considered by other jurisdictions. So what you're asking, what this bill would do is pass a law that, then this group is going to study the industry in which you're going to base the law. So it's a little bit backwards. And that's a problem. The other thing is, let me address some of the specific issues with the bill. And while the bill is laudable in many respects, and I want to point out that we think accuracy of records is important, and it's one of the principles of fair information practice principles that Reed Elsevier complies with. We're governed by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And to the extent that our information would be inaccurate, it would be very valuable to our customers. Let me point out that we deal with public information. The information we acquire is from public sources. But this bill reaches far beyond housing and employment and volunteerism that you're probably interested in. For example, it would cover any other services such as people who run MySpace may check the background of people who are participating. There are dating services that are online that want to make sure that Jack the Ripper isn't one of the people applying. If you're hiring a nanny or a contractor, finding a roommate and other things. And volunteerism is a big issue, too. This bill would allegedly cover all of those areas, and they've not been thought through. In a Fair Credit Reporting Act, I think it does. But this would cover these areas. For example, Senator Higgins talked about the volunteers in the park board. one of the companies that I'm familiar with, not ours, is employed by the Boy Scouts and Little League to screen potential leaders, adult leaders in these groups. And they were able, in the screening, they found in excess of 600 sex offenders that applied for these positions. Now, this law applies to that as well. These are not employment, and they're not housing, and they're not credit, but they are other issues, which are important to be done. They serve a societal good. Also, I have some specific language with problem with the language of the bill. For example, it refers to 30 days. We don't necessarily get information on 30 days. We may get it on a monthly basis, whatever the contract is with the vendor. And we contract with public agencies to obtain that information. So the 30 days is probably not a practical item. Secondly, we don't know what update means. Let me give you an example. When we get an updated record, if Senator Foley's record is now blemished because he's got some sort of thing he did in the last month, we would get that. However, if Senator Foley had had a previous record and now it's been expunged, we get an updated record of the changes, but we don't know what's happened. We wouldn't know that it's been expunged or sealed because we don't get any notice of that. There's no public folder of that. So how would we know to take it out? The way we find out now is when Senator Foley comes and tells us that, look, I have an expungement, we take it out. But we don't have any way of knowing that, typically in a way the information is presented to us. The other thing is got to, we have to determine that the information is, if somebody comes to us and says we have to investigate because there's an error, and the only way we can throw it out is if it's frivolous. Well, frivolous means that it's totally silly. For example, somebody comes in and says, I'm not the subject of that data because I'm Santa Claus. That's pretty silly, and we can throw that out. But if he comes in and says something with some theoretical sort of credibility, we have to investigate it. If it really is some case where there's no basis to it at all, we spent a fair amount of money doing that. And in this case, we don't get any attorney's fees for that. But the practical problems are with expungement. And let me give you a real example of how, in my experience, I represented an individual in a pro bono matter a few years ago who was in a nursing home, a fairly young fellow in his late 20s, but he was a quadriplegic. And he wanted to get into an apartment. He was from the Chicago area. They did a background check to get him in the apartment, and they said he had a criminal record for armed robbery in the state of Illinois. Well, it was a case where the person in prison actually committed a crime and stole his identity, but he was in prison in Illinois, the other guy was. And this guy had been a quadriplegic since he was 18, and it was pretty unlikely that he could have committed an armed robbery of a institution during that period. But in any event, who is responsible for correcting that record? Are we, as a vendor, how do we know whether that record's accurate or inaccurate? We get an official record from the government that says this person's been convicted. And he says it's not me. Okay, we investigate and find out whether our information is accurate. The information I was told by the credit bureau in Chicago that did the background check was, well, it's the official record of Cook County. They said, if you need to correct it, go to Cook County and have it corrected. Well, I mean, he's up here, he doesn't have any money, and we're not going down to Cook County. I did contact the authorities in Cook County to see whether I could make a change. I think it would have been easier to seek a change in the Kremlin's position on Crimea than it would be to get a criminal record corrected in Cook County. But in any event, the ultimate solution was I just beat the crap out of the credit bureau and threatened them with a lawsuit. They finally caved in, but it was such an egregious case where I could show that I showed them that the person was actually the criminal was in prison in Illinois, and this guy's a quadriplegic and all that. So they relented on that. But I use that to illustrate the point. If somebody comes to us and says this record's inaccurate, we got the official record from the state that says that this is the case, and now this person says, well, that's wrong. Okay, we investigate. We go back to the state, and the state says that's the record. What are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to change our records? And if we did that, suppose this would happen then. Suppose we had done that in good faith, but that change was procured by the individual by fraud. So they committed fraud on us, but we, in good faith, acted on it. Now we've given that information to a prospective employer. What's our liability? I think there's all kinds of problems with this, the way this bill is drafted. I laud the intention of the people. I've spent a great deal of time talking with them at different times, but I don't think the bill is properly drafted. If you wanted to make the bill workable, I would suggest that you limit it to what you're talking about, or what the major purpose is, and that's to determine eligibility for housing, employment, and volunteerism. Because those systems are set up. They're under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. I don't know about the volunteerism, but the others are. And you could deal with it, but you wouldn't get into the other databases that exist that are used for social purpose, the online dating and things like that, where the people that run those organizations or dating services want to make sure that they're dealing with who they say they are and that person is not a criminal or something else. So, Madam Chair, in the current form, I think I would encourage you to defer to this task force that's studying the data mining issue. And they'll be done we're supposed to be done by July. have some recommendations. And if that, if you don't want to do that, then I would suggest some major amendments to the bill, because there's some practical problems for us to try to implement it. And you know, the third thing, but if you wanted to go ahead, I'd suggest you limit it to employment, housing, and volunteerism. Thank you. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Tennyson, are you intending to participate in that work group?
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
I'm sure they'll appreciate your input.
Sometimes.
Senator Betzel?
A lot of the people are here who are in that work group.
Senator Betzel?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't know if it's quite easy to address all of Mr. Tennyson's concerns. One, I think, would be quite easy. On page 1, line 16, it says that it has to be updated within the previous 30 days. And he said that normally databases are updated on a monthly basis. And so I think, you know, within the previous month, I think, would be, no. In February, you're going to have to do it sooner, you know. But March, you got an extra day. But I think that may be a good point, that if that's how the industry does it, we should probably consider changing 30 days to a month.
So Senator Betzel moves on line 1.16, delete 30 days and insert month. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Betzel, what's your desire with
Madam Chair, as I say, we're at crunch time here. I'd like to move the bill, and if it does seem that there's better ways to handle this issue, I'm certainly open to discussing that. But this committee's out of time to deal with this right now. So I'll move the Senate File 914 as amended. Be recommended pass.
On that motion, any further discussions from the members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. And prevails. Senator Betzel, while you're sitting there, will you just present Senate File 2645?
Your bill?
Yep.
I need to get my copy of it.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's a really complicated
bill. Yes. Madam Chair, this is your bill, which I presented in your absence. Right now, this current law requires that the Social Security number be part of a petition for marriage dissolution, and the petition is part of a public file. And, of course, we are trying to prevent people from making their Social Security number part of the public record. However, the federal law does require that the Social Security number be available and used in dissolution cases, or particularly for child support issues, whether there's a dissolution or not, because that is one of the tools that is being used to collect child support. So there's actually court rules that provide for the collection of the Social Security numbers. It's an information sheet. It's not part of the public record, but it is part of the dissolution proceeding. And so this simply requires a statutory requirement that the Social Security number be part of the petition. It does not eliminate the use of the Social Security number as part of the proceeding, which can be done separately.
And Senator Betzel, I understand that the council was directed result of the subcommittee hearing to draft an amendment to address the Social Security number with respect to child support. So there's an A1 amendment to address that.
Okay, that may be up.
Ms. Pontius? Oh, sorry, we'll get that.
Thank you. Yes, it's at my spot here.
Madam Chair and members, federal law does require states to collect Social Security numbers as part of the pleadings.
Right.
And what the courts have done under their own rules already is to actually have a separate document so that the Social Security number is not in the public document, the petition. And this would, the Department of Human Services expressed concerns that even though the court was doing that by rule, we still needed something in the statute requiring the numbers to be collected. So this basically just mirrors what the current practice is. There's a separate document that would be filed at the same time as the petition that would have the Social Security number information in it, and that is kept separate from the court file that's accessible to the public.
Questions?
I'll move the A1 amendment.
Senator Betzel moves the A1 amendment. Any discussions? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Anybody in the audience wants to testify on that amendment and the A1 amendment? I know that testimony has already been taken on the bill.
All right, Senator Betzold, Senate File 2645, as amended.
Madam Chair, on behalf of you,
yes,
I move that Senate File 2645, as amended, be recommended to pass. And refer to the
Thank
floor.
You. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. On my own behalf, I thank you. And I think we are finished with our morning agenda. We're going to, Senator Betzel, I understand that a third-party vendor is coming this afternoon for 2754. And then we will bring back up Senator Olson's 3235. And with the potential to, if we could narrow the language, with the potential to amend an amendment with respect to Hennepin County. All right. So the committee will be in recess till, let's say, 1 o'clock. All right?
Okay.
Recess till 1 o'clock. Thank you.
I'll be in good luck.